staring at him with frozen smiles. He simply sat, drugged out, and didn't seem to notice the missing Steinway. He started talking about how he wanted us to start over in our relationship. I was so nervous, I just played along with him. I told him that it would be best if someone could pick him up and give me time to think about it. Now, it made no logical sense to have him picked up since he had his new Ford Explorer, but luckily his addled mind went along with the plan. A druggy friend of his picked him up. I said to Eve, "This is it. This is our chance." We threw everything we owned, mostly just clothes, into the back of the Explorer and took off like bats out of hell. I drove like a possessed person, and we made a 24-hour drive in just 18 hours. Once I got to Seattle, I dropped Eve off and went to the Ford dealership. I forged William's signature on the car's pink slip and traded it in for a spaceship-like sports car and never looked back. That was the end of William for me. I felt some guilt, but my missing toenails reminded me that I shouldn't feel too bad. I was nervous to see my dad, who was frosty to me, but he still gave me an awkward hug upon seeing me. I said a teary goodbye to Eve, got some of my stuff from my dad's house, threw it in my new space pod of a car, and took off. It was time to move on to my new life, and that included Brett. I drove back down to Los Angeles, drinking Diet Pepsi in place of food to keep me going. Not obsessively exercising was really hard. I felt extremely guilty and extremely fat. I called Brett numerous times on the drive back down, but I couldn't reach him. I kept leaving messages. When I got to Hollywood's Highland Avenue exit, right by the Hollywood Bowl, I called him again from a payphone. I was starting to panic about having no place to stay. I hung up and called again. A man answered the phone, and it wasn't Brett. The voice identified himself as LAPD and said, "Brett has been murdered." My blood ran cold, and I remember nothing after that. I found out later Brett was stabbed 23 times and almost decapitated. My world, my hope, went black. I fell to the ground and went catatonic. I don't remember much until the funeral. Everything went so dark and I couldn't stop crying. He had been stolen. I couldn't stop thinking about how much fear he must have experienced in his final moments on Earth, how much rage and terror his kind soul had absorbed. I shudder even now thinking about it. He'll always have a piece of my heart. The case is still unsolved, but I have been trying for years to remedy that. Embarrassingly, I also had the fleeting and fucked up thought that the magnitude of his death would cure my disordered mind and get me back to being the brave girl I was. I was so bored with thinking about my body. At the funeral, they played "Wish You Were Here" by Pink Floyd, and I can honestly say, I wish Brett were still here. He deserved to have a full life. He deserved to keep shining. I sat down and cried and cried. I saw his brother Cliff at the funeral and thought he was the darkness to Brett's lightness, both physically and in personality. It's bizarre, but within 2 weeks of the funeral, I went to coffee with Cliff. They say statistically, there's a high likelihood that the surviving partner will go out with the best friend or relative of a deceased partner. I wound up going out with Cliff, which was a mindfuck for sure. When someone dies, it stops your relationship exactly where it was. So I felt like I went from 0 to 30 with Brett, and then went from 30 to 100 with his brother. It was weird, but men were my ports in a storm, you know? The friend of Brett's I was supposed to stay with disappeared after I stayed there for a couple weeks, and once again I had nowhere else to go. So I wound up staying with Cliff. Cliff inherited his brother's record company job, his nightclub, his girlfriend, and his car. That must have been so psychologically challenging. I know it was for me. I'd look at him and imagine he was my lost love. We both needed each other as a connection to Brett. I started Overeaters Anonymous more seriously because Cliff was also sober and in AA like Brett was. It helped me immensely. I was called the Toast Girl because the first year in recovery, I ate toast 3 times a day. That was what I committed to doing, and I cried every time I did it because I felt my body expanding and my brain going crazy with the fatness. I kept a diary at the time that I filled with horrible, crazy, mean scribbles, like fucking fat ass, written 1,000 times. I guess I was vomiting on the page versus actual vomiting, which I was never good at. It was after Brett died and after I joined OA that I started doing the real work of my life, dissecting things, studying them from all angles. OA's 12 steps are basically the same as AA's. Granted, I never made it past 10. Those final two steps are explicitly about regular prayer and spiritual awakening, and I didn't want anything to do with God. It was too loaded with trauma for me to get there at the time. 3 weeks after Brett was killed, I was standing by the front of a gym, waiting for my friend Josh, weeping over Brett again. At this point, the sobs had turned into a sort of constant leak, so I was just standing there leaking when this woman came up to me and asked me if I was an actress. If she had been a man, maybe I wouldn't be sitting here right now, because if you're a beautiful girl in LA, countless men come up and say, "Are you an actress?" just to see if they can sleep with you. But because it was a woman, I gave it a little bit of credence. I told her no. "Well, do you want to be an actress?" "No." I had just turned 20. My idea of actors was based on the stereotypes that actors were selfish, self-obsessed, fame-hungry. I had the self-obsession part down because of my disorder, but not the other parts. I never had that hole in my soul that could only be filled with outside things, including fame. I knew from William that things couldn't make me happy. I knew deep down that happiness was an inside job. It turned out the woman was a producer friend of a director named Greg Araki, a famed indie director I hadn't heard of. Greg had looked far and wide for the lead in his upcoming film, The Doom Generation, and hadn't found her yet. I was undecided, but I gave the woman my number. They called for about a week trying to get a hold of me. It was my friend Joshua from class of 1999 who convinced me to go meet with the movie people. At last I met with them. I had to go deep into the valley, outside of LA. I remember not wanting to drive all that way. But after asking how much money I'd get paid, $10,000, I realized it was enough for first, last, and deposit to rent a room and a house. I'd have enough left over to go to Paris and visit the Empress Josephine's summer home, the Chateau de Montmaison. I would not have to go back to cold, rainy Seattle and my dad. My deciding factor on being an actress came down to that. Dad, Paris, and rain avoidance. So I met the director. I thought he had a fun, infectious personality. The audition commenced. One of the male stars was there. Araki told me they needed to test us for chemistry. The actor was lying flat on a couch. I was made to lie on top of him. He was lying on his back and he had an erection. I could feel it, which wasn't his fault, but I think it is a really messed up way to do a chemistry test. Imagine it happening at your job interview. I did the same thing that I always did. I snapped out of my body and floated up to the ceiling. I guess we had chemistry. I got the part of Amy Blue. It begins. It doesn't happen that way, being discovered. An incredibly rare thing happened to me, that Greg Araki and the investors took a chance on a complete unknown is like one in a million, maybe more. Interviewers have asked me what I'd have done if it weren't for acting, and my answer is usually I'd have been a pathologist or archaeologist, but it's probably not true. The reality is I don't know what I would have done because, frankly, it was always a foregone conclusion that I was bound for movies in some way. My life was always going to be big, even when I tried to make it small. Doom Generation was like acting boot camp for me. I knew very little about technical aspects of filmmaking. They would tell me, "Stand on your mark." I didn't know what a mark meant. I just wandered across the room. "The X on the floor, that's where you stand." They said, "Watch your camera framing. That means how much room you have, like in the invisible box around your head from the camera's viewpoint. You can't step too far to the left or too far to the right or you'll be out of the shot. Let's rehearse blocking." Blocking is where you go from point A to Z in any given scene. You have to remember all that and then forget all of it to make it natural. It was a difficult shoot because we had a very short amount of filming time. and we had about 3 takes worth of film for each scene. I tried my best to get everything right all the time. My character, Amy Blue, was a snarling, red-lipsticked 16-year-old. I didn't know about creating a character, so I just based her on me at 14. A permanently pissed-off punk. I related immensely. Through Amy Blue, I could channel my anger. The first day of filming, there was a huge earthquake in L.A., the biggest in decades. I remember it was like surfing in bed, and I kept laughing, thinking it was super fun. Later, I found out people died, so it was not so fun in reality. We filmed mostly at night in abandoned places on the edge of the city for a post-apocalyptic vibe. I thought the aesthetic was really cool. Greg Araki told us we'd be tired and cold, so I knew what to prepare for, and he was right. One of the 2 male stars, very good-looking, as you'd expect, was permitted his bad behavior. It was the first time I'd heard about method acting, where the actor stays in character all the time, even when the camera isn't rolling. I have never met a female method actor. To me, "I'm a method actor" is usually synonymous with "I'm going to be a fucking dick to everybody on set." It's something so many young male Marlon Brando wannabe actors do, and I've never been on a set where that bad behavior wasn't indulged. I wasn't impressed, and I wasn't turned on by him either, which I think may have confused him. He was incredibly mean to me. My boyfriend had just died. Everybody knew about Brett. I was shocked, but it was like nobody cared. I quickly learned nobody was going to protect me. There was a defining moment when the favoritism, the misogyny, the toxic environment on movie sets became real for me. But I didn't know how to articulate it then. I didn't understand why these guys were allowed to get away with everything and permit it all. We were shooting a scene with the actor and me in the front seat of a car. The director and cameraman were in the back seat filming my close-up while the male actor gave me my lines from off-camera. All of a sudden, I felt something wet under my skirt and an insistent pushing pressure on my vagina. The actor had taken a bottle of water under my skirt to spray and push onto my privates. I froze. Then I snapped. I went to lunge for him, but the camera was in the way. Greg Araki just said, "Oh, children." Later, I told that story in an interview, and Greg Araki wrote a long response that I skimmed and mostly don't remember, except for the last part where he said, "Rose remembers it wrong." To me, that is the height of misogyny and victim blaming. Gaslighting. "Don't gaslight me, motherfucker. My vagina remembers. My body remembers. It is a scientific fact that memory changes every time we bring it up, but the body has memory that is even more accurate than the mind. Women know when they have been violated emotionally, physically, or verbally, and no man has the right to tell us otherwise. Our bodies shake. They burn. They do all kinds of things when they remember. Our muscles remember. We know by the way we feel when we have been violated. Even when we are drunk, we know the difference between welcome and unwelcome. The body always feels it during and after." The male actor has since apologized, and it is an apology I completely accept. There is no bad blood between him and me. I think he's great. I still respect Araki's work, and I'm still grateful they took a chance on me, but everyone on sets should be respected, not just the males. The producer was a young woman at the time, although still the better part of a decade older than I was then. I ran into her years later, and I brought it up with her how disappointed I was that she didn't protect a young girl. That happened over and over in films I did. It was like they didn't really even see me. I was just the girl, and it was okay to be treated poorly. But it's not okay. So I did the only thing I could do. I pretended like I was one of the people in my books, the characters that I'd turn into when I read as a child. I created my own character in my own version of the movie that I had in my head. Later on, I realized that the movie in my head was often a lot more interesting than the actual movie I was in. I eventually came to look at it like I was doing performance art in other people's worlds. Like what Cindy Sherman did in Photographs, transforming herself into other people and other lives. It was an attempt to preserve my sanity and the part I most enjoyed. In The Doom Generation, I had to shoot a three-way sex scene, which actually wound up being almost comical because we were all wearing sweatpants and slippers and just making sexy noises. On film, it looked super sexy, but in real life, it felt as if there were eerie sex cult parallels that I couldn't clearly articulate even to myself. At the time, I thought the language in the film was like 95% made-up slang. Some years later, I did the DVD commentary, and I finally was adult enough to understand what I had been saying in the movie. Holy shit. No wonder my dad chased Greg Araki out of the Seattle Film Festival and tried to beat him up. In January 1995, I went to my first Sundance Film Festival with The Doom Generation. The excitement was palpable in the thin mountain air of Park City. Some people were so upset by the film that they walked out of our screenings. It was a very polarizing movie. Nothing like a little nihilism to freak people out. I loved it. Despite my experiences on the set, I thought Araki and all of us involved in that film created something really cool and different. I would go on to be nominated for the Best Debut Performance at the Independent Spirit Awards, like the Oscars for independent films. There were lawyers everywhere at Sundance. I didn't understand why they were all giving me their cards. It reminded me of my runaway days, with troll men creeping around trying to prey on you. I had no idea why I'd need a lawyer. I had come into the whole industry backwards, and because of that, didn't know the rules. Normally, you come to Hollywood, enroll in an acting class, do workshops hoping an agent may choose you, start by trying to get on a commercial, work your way up to a one-line role on TV, maybe play a dead body or something, then try for a featured guest star, then a little role in an indie film, then hopefully a bigger one, and then the holy grail, starring in either a TV show or film. As you slowly climb the ladder, normally it takes years and lots of luck. You learn who the sharks are, but not me. I was a baby in the industry and working at a level beyond my understanding. So I had never heard the rumors of what creeps to avoid, who to trust, if anyone. I was so innocent to the games played, it just didn't occur to me that people would lie to me, that they would have nefarious motives. I didn't know I needed to be scared of those who smiled and extended a hand to me. There was one lawyer at Sundance, a little guy in cowboy boots, who approached me and explained why I needed a lawyer. He signed me and he got me an agent, and it went from there. They immediately put me in a Pauly Shore movie because I needed money for rent. Sure, I'd done my first lead in the film, which I think people assume means you're rich, but I wasn't paid enough money to be able to afford more than a tiny apartment, which I shared with this girl, Julie, who was 6'1" with short platinum blonde hair, a loud Australian who sounded like a giant toucan bird squawking all the time. I loved her. Being that I was now an actor, I kept waiting to feel like I had caught the acting bug. I read about other actors and their passion for the craft, and I kept waiting for that passion to hit me. I loved film so much. I loved how sets worked and that we could make things that affected people and shaped minds. But the bug wasn't coming. The indignities that went along with being an actress, I resented greatly. You know what it's like to go on a job interview and the stress discomfort that goes along with it? Now imagine that in your job interview, you're required to break down and sob, or laugh maniacally, all while looking sexy. Imagine being asked to do humiliating things like stand and turn so they can see your body, a group of men staring at your ass and tits but pretending it's about the role. Auditioning for me was always traumatic, like that hallway scene from when I was a child in the cult. Here's how it would go. I walk down a hallway. My heart is already racing, and I feel short of breath. There are maybe 10 women on one side, 10 women on the other, on little folding chairs under fluorescent lights. Everyone is in a teeny dress and heels or trying to look like the part, whatever it may be. I feel a surge of embarrassment being there with my hand out asking for the powers that be to choose me. I hate it. I hate every minute of it. The women give me the once-over and try to vibe me out. It feels like my skin is being pulled off with needles because I'm in a cattle call and I can see what I'm up against. The night before, I worked hard to memorize the two scenes from a script that some mediocre asshole guy wrote and thought was great. Whatever, I need the job. I'm required to scream and wail for the part. I'm sitting outside in the hallway now with these 10 to 20 other actresses, and I can hear the muffled screams from inside the casting room. I try to tune the wailer out. After waiting an hour or so, it's my turn. They call me in. My heart starts racing even faster. My hands sweat, and my chest is turning red. I can feel the color splotches rising. I walk into a small box-like room. There's a camera set up to film me. There are 5 men in the room, with a female casting director and the assistant operating the video camera. They're sitting in a semicircle, staring at me. Hideous fluorescent lighting once again. I wonder how anyone ever gets hired under lights like these. I say hello to everybody in the tiny bit of time I have to impress them. My hands shake the script papers I'm holding. The reality is that behind the scenes, they most likely already know who they're going to cast. They have offers out to stars while I'm auditioning. They keep the auditioning going to have leverage and maybe a backup plan. I know that they're looking for a bigger name. I still go on the off chance if something doesn't work out. Maybe they'll pick me. I hold my script scene papers in my shaking hand in case I forget the words. I proceed to do the scene. I, too, start wailing and crying at the appropriate moment. I wonder if everybody else out there is thinking the same thing as I'm thinking. But then I think maybe not, because maybe they want to be here. Being that I was the accidental actor, I don't want to be here. I find it excruciating, very embarrassing, and I resent being treated like cattle, just one of many. I have tears rolling down my cheeks. They ask me to do the second scene again. Is that a good sign? Thanks, Rose. Good to see you. The casting director dismisses me. I shake her hand and say, thanks. Okay, bye. All that crying and screaming, I'm just going to shove back down inside of my body. My poor body that doesn't know what's going on or why I dredged up intense feelings. Now I have to walk the gauntlet down the hallway past the other actresses staring at me. I seethe inside. I walk down the street looking for a trash bin to ditch my script pages. I always throw the script pages away as soon as possible because I don't want to be seen as an actress walking down the street. I don't want to add to my walk of shame. In 2 days, I have another audition, and I'll have to do it again. I was sent in to audition for the role of Tatum Riley on an upcoming horror film, Scream. I was hoping they wouldn't lay me on top of anybody this time. Thankfully, it was just the usual screaming, sobbing bit, and I did well enough. I got a call from my agent and was offered $50,000 for the part. Holy cow, that was the most money I had ever heard of coming my way. Protocol would have been for my lawyer to counteroffer $100,000, and then I'd wind up getting $75,000, but my lawyer went back at $250,000. This so infuriated the head of the studio, he made me retest a filmed audition for the role 3 more times, even though I'd already had an offer. To me, it felt like the studio head wanted to humiliate me and penalize me for my lawyer's pissing contest move. That's what they do. Punish the girl for the actions of the representative. Before I could retest, they hired Nev Campbell, an actress with dark hair. I thought, oh God, they're never going to hire me now because I have dark hair too. Those are the rules. I mentioned to the blonde producer that I was thinking of going blonde. Everyone's eyes lit up. Ding, ding, ding. Because, you know, you can only have multiple females on screen if they have different hair colors because otherwise they think the audience is too stupid to tell them apart. I had no desire to be blonde, but I knew that was the only way I'd get hired. One of the producers promptly took me to her hairdresser who turned me into a Midwestern blonde. My plan worked. I was officially offered the part, but for less than all my counterparts because of said money-pissing contest. After paying my agent, manager, and lawyer, I wound up probably with $12,500. But it was still the most money I had ever seen. My character died in Scream, but I wanted her to be more than a disposable young woman in a horror film. I was determined to make people feel for my character, Tatum Riley. I did not want her to go down without a fight. I wanted her to be memorable as a human. No one discusses how disconnected people are when they watch horror films. God forbid you watch someone die awfully and you feel something. If you don't think this translates to real-life numbness, you're deluding yourself. Numbing yourself to violence against women comes early, and if it's not coming to you at your home, and I hope it's not, then it's coming to you through your TV and film. What I thought the original Scream did very well was to make you care about each character. We weren't disposable. I'm proud of creating an indelible character who had one of the all-time most memorable deaths on screen. I'm also proud of doing my own stunt work in the famous garage door death scene, the scene where Tatum dies. I ended up with bruises from my shoulders to my waist, but I knew it would look better. When I arrived on the set of Scream, who should I see? The same old creepy guy from my job as an extra on Class of 1999. The guy who molested me. He saw me and said, "I know you from somewhere. Don't I know you?" My heart started racing, but I had blonde hair, so he didn't quite recognize me. He got replaced a week into filming, which made me incredibly happy. Aside from that, the set of Scream was a refuge for me. Wes Craven was a special and complex man. He grew up speaking in tongues in a Baptist church. He came from Ohio, where I think he was a teacher, and he left with his young children, or child and his wife, moved to New York City, became a taxi driver, and made his dreams come true. I totally respect that. He treated us actors like his equals, and it was a very special environment. Wes Craven was so kind, a true gentleman. I thought all my movies with big directors were going to be like this one. I was wrong. We all kind of knew we were making something sort of magical, but we couldn't anticipate that it would become the phenomenon it did. Especially not me, who knew nothing about box office numbers and things like that. I got a puppy, a Boston Terrier, Bug, a week before I went to film Scream. Bug was an extraordinarily trippy dog. She was on sale at the Beverly Center, a big ugly mall in Los Angeles. I walked by one day, and I saw this tiny black and white thing with two giant eyes going different directions, her paws stuck through the metal cage wires. I noticed her price, and that she'd been put on sale twice. And I thought, I understand what it's like to be discounted. This is the dog for me. Wes Craven fell in love with Bug, as did I. She grew up on sets. She understood that she had to be quiet during takes. She was flawless. She would be perfectly still and not even jangle her collar. She was photographed many times with my boy dog, Fester, another Boston I got a couple months later. They were photographed by Bruce Weber, Ellen Von Unworth, David LaChapelle, some of the biggest photographers ever. Bug was quite a catch on the set, let me tell you. She added that extra oomph of weirdness. Shortly after Scream, I went to the dentist. I was lying prone with my mouth open as wide as it would go in a fancy Beverly Hills dental office when the dentist stared into my mouth and declared, "You do not have movie star teeth." And I believed him, even though at this point I was technically starring in movies. As if I wanted some Hollywood bullshit teeth like his, with fake, overly white chiclets gnashing at the prospect of profiting off me. That was what my better self was saying. But how do you keep that better self intact when everything in the Hollywood system, in the media world, and the training you get as a young woman in the society tells you to do away with your realness? The idea of not having movie star teeth stuck. I was sure when Scream came out, my crooked teeth were going to look 5 feet tall on screen. At the premiere, it was all I could focus on, my fucked up teeth. I should have pointed out that I was a movie star even with my crooked teeth. But I didn't go that route. I started to straighten my teeth, something I actually regret doing. Most especially because it was an implanted idea, not one of my own. The bullshit brainwashing had begun in earnest. The bigger picture is that I was the one whose face was going to be blown up and sent around the world to influence the rest of the population to look homogenized. Little did I know that by being on screen, I was a stand-in for all women. That was my role. I just didn't know it yet. And my straightened teeth were part of that messaging. Death of self. Most people have certain landmark experiences or events that become major milestones. High school, prom, college, wedding, that kind of stuff. Mine were truncated into an on-screen version. Scream was my version of college. And if Scream was college for me, Jawbreaker, which came next, was going backward into high school. It would be the only prom I would ever attend. In fact, my character, Courtney Alice Shane, doesn't just go to prom in an amazing gown, she wins prom queen. It's all going well until someone plays a recording of Courtney confessing to murder over the loudspeakers, and then the entire student body turns on her, pelting her with their corsages and cursing her. So that was my prom. I love the character I played. She was amoral, but I think sociopaths don't tend to be aware of the fact that they're sociopaths. So she just thought, what's the big deal? I saw a classic film where the actress Jean Tierney played a sociopathic character. The film was called Leave Her to Heaven. In that, she pushes a little kid in a wheelchair off a cliff. When her husband says, "Why did you do that to Timmy?" she responds, "But darling, we needed more time alone together." I always thought that was bizarrely hilarious, and so I based Courtney Alice Shane on her, a character that was my tip of the hat to classic Hollywood. With Darren Stein, the great writer and director of Jawbreaker, I turned Courtney Shane into an iconic character. The other girls did a tremendous job in that movie as well. In 1997, I had started doing another movie, Phantoms, made by the same studio that did Scream, Miramax. While still filming, I was sent back to the Sundance Film Festival in late January. This time, I was to be the belle of the ball. I had 4 movies at Sundance that year, 1 short and 3 films. One of my films at Sundance was called Going All the Way. It's set in the 1950s, a beautiful little film with a great production designer, great costume designer, and a great director. Jeremy Davies, the lead actor with whom I was friendly before we started shooting, was in it too. I had to do a topless scene with him. In the scene, I'm trying to turn him on and he can't get it up. I'd done topless scenes in Doom Generation, and I thought this time it would be easier since I knew the actor previously, but it wound up being way more difficult. It was harder to detach from my body as I had done during Doom Generation, and I felt it this time. I cried after filming the scene. At the Sundance premiere for Going All the Way, I took my seat in the theater. My heart racing with nerves as I would shortly be seeing myself on screen, something that I couldn't get used to. My manager, Jill, who was seated next to me, whispered in my ear, telling me the head of the famed studio Miramax was sitting behind me in the theater. Miramax, owned by Disney, was the super powerful company that owned the company that produced Scream and was producing the movie I was currently starring in with Ben Affleck, Phantoms. In fact, it was my second film with Affleck because he was also in Going All the Way. The lights dimmed in the theater. I had seen the studio head's name in the credits of Scream, but had never seen his face. I didn't want to turn around and make it obvious that I was looking, so I kept my eyes forward. I went back to watching the movie. The topless scene came on, and I wanted the ground to swallow me up. It had been really hard shooting that scene in the first place. And I sat there remembering how I cried after filming it. I slid farther down in my seat. I noticed my manager turning and nodding in the direction of the studio head. When I replay the chain of events in my head, I'll always be chilled by that nod. I wondered what the nod meant for 20 years. Now I know. By now we all know the monster's name, but I have made a choice not to use it. I do not like the monster's name, and though I know it, and maybe you know it, I refuse to have his name in my book. When the film ended, the studio head was gone. He must have left early. Jill was super excited when she told me that the studio head had summoned me to a business meeting the next day, a 10 a.m. meeting at the fanciest hotel in Park City, the Stein Erickson. I was to meet him in the restaurant. Later on, I would wonder whether the meeting got set up while we were watching the movie. Jill told me the studio head was a known star maker, that this was my big chance to make a great impression. I told her since I already was into movies produced by him, it was a safe bet I already had made a good impression, and asked why I needed to go to the meeting if I was already employed. But she insisted the meeting was necessary and that I go. I said yes, and the meeting was added to my already packed schedule the next day. Jill told me that this man wielded an incredible amount of power in Hollywood. I could sense it by the way she was breathlessly talking about him. I was so new to the industry's upper echelon, I didn't know anything about this man or what exactly his kind of power meant. I didn't know what so many already knew, that he was a predator, and I was walking into a trap. A trap that started the 20-year conspiracy of collusion. The next morning at Sundance, I got up early, ready for my meeting with him. Before the full day of press I had to do for the other three films I had at Sundance. I was overwhelmed just thinking about my to-do list, but I figured with Jill the manager at my side, I'd be able to pull it off. I have thought a lot about the day my life got hijacked by evil. There was an MTV camera crew following me around that day. A day in the life of Rose McGowan was the theme. The MTV crew was to wait outside the front of the hotel until I returned from my meeting. I've kicked myself through the years because before I went into this fateful meeting, I turned to the MTV camera and with a big, genuine smile said, "I think my life is finally getting easier." I thought since I was now achieving a little financial stability and was in nicer environments that it meant life was easing up a bit. I was tired of surviving. I was tired of fear. I was tired of pain. I was tired of hurting. I wanted to soar. I wanted to fly. I wanted to be free. Instead, I got a prison sentence. I waved goodbye to the camera, walked into the hotel, and made my way to the restaurant. I said a chipper good morning to the grim-faced restaurant host. He told me that the studio head was stuck on a call, working from the office in his suite, and that I was meant to go up and wait. I smiled at the host and thanked him, but he turned away and didn't smile back. I remember thinking, well, he's not very friendly. I found the room number and knocked on the door. Two male assistants opened the door. I offered them another chipper. Good morning. The men said nothing and looked down. I thought, well, gosh, they're not so friendly either. They pushed past me silently and left me alone to walk in the room. When most people hear hotel room, they imagine a bed, dresser, and little bathroom. The monster's hotel room was the entire floor of the hotel, probably about 3,000 square feet, like an average to large size house, definitely not the small hotel room the mind conjures. I went inside and into the largest living room I had ever seen, and there my boss was, the studio head himself, on one end of a huge couch, talking loudly on the phone. He gestured for me to sit down. He kept talking loudly on the phone while I waited for about 5 minutes for him to finish his call. I had time to study him. I was repulsed immediately. The studio head was not attractive in the least. Let's just say it would be the understatement of the century to say that he would never win a beauty pageant. Well, maybe a beauty pageant in hell. He might win the award for most monstrous. He's a very large person, vertically and horizontally, oily skinned, his face pockmarked with a bulbous, fleshy nose and liver lips. His right eye squinches up more than the left, giving him a lopsided look. He reminded me of a melted pineapple. He could be the boogeyman of your worst nightmares. He became mine. I sat on a far end of a couch, and he sat about 5 feet away while he talked loudly on the phone. I stared at the ceiling so I didn't have to look at his face. Eventually, he finished up his phone call, and we proceeded to have our meeting. I figured I'd do what I did best, use my intelligence and wit to prove I was different from the stereotype of an actress. Even being new in my career, I already resented being lumped in with the actress cliché. I was certain we would be working together for many years to come, and we were here to plot out the grand arc of my career. That's how my manager had framed this very significant meeting. Those were my earnest, enthused expectations. I mean, if you were in the middle of your second extremely high-profile job for a company, would you not assume that you were already a valuable employee with a big future? Looking back, I want to hug myself for being so naive. I really thought this was a business meeting and that this creep cared what I had to say. I was so wrong. Later, I'd find out that other actresses had been warned about what could happen when the studio had summoned you to a meeting. Later, I'd find out lots of things. Completely unbeknownst to me, an industry newbie, this hideous beast had a long track record of preying on young women. Turns out, even in 1997, this was an open secret in the industry. Sadly, it seemed everybody in Hollywood on the business side knew that if you got summoned to a meeting, it was probably going to go differently than you expected. But I didn't know the rumblings and the secrets, the gossip and the warning signs. As a street kid, I had known to be on guard for the trolls. It just never occurred to me that the head troll would be in Hollywood, that these fancy people were in fact more dangerous than those on the streets. These people, in their $3,500 suits, could be far more evil than a guy who's just cruising you to get ass one night on the street corner. You know why? Because these are the creeps who spread their rot to our world. The studio had asked about the kinds of projects I wanted to do. What a banal question, I thought. I said I wanted to do projects that mattered. He seemed like a smartish man, gruff, rough around the edges, not particularly well-mannered. Piggy, to be honest. I was taken aback by his size and ugliness. I covered it by talking about my love of classic films. Apropos of nothing, he said he had a jacuzzi in his hotel room. Okay, non sequitur much? I figured the jacuzzi comment was a brag about being rich and having a jacuzzi, which I thought was tacky. I didn't realize it was part of the setup. I didn't know what to answer, so I continued with my story. At about 10:30 a.m., we wrapped up the meeting, and he said he'd walk me out. I thought, well, that went well. It was my first meeting with a bigwig. I couldn't wait to tell my manager, Jill, all about it. I figured she'd be proud of me. I exited the living room and walked down a hallway. Walking behind me, his huge size seemed even more overwhelming. I'm 5'4". It seemed like he was 6'4" tall and 6'4" wide. He probably weighed 3 times as much as I did, if not more. My brain was already outside and onto its next task, the exit interview. The MTV camera was waiting for me outside and would be filming as I exited the building. I was hoping my makeup still looked good. In the hallway, we passed a door. Suddenly, he stops me and says, "This is the jacuzzi room." I didn't know what to do, so I politely looked in and told him it looked nice. I had no idea why I was being stopped to look at a jacuzzi when we all know what they look like. I made the appropriate, "You have a nice jacuzzi" sounds. It's super hot and humid. I feel a hand on my back, and it pushes me farther into the tiny, dark, incredibly hot room. Everything at this point happens so quickly, and yet so slowly. I'm confused as to why I'm in this room. I can't breathe. He's standing right in front of me, taking all the space in the wood-paneled room. It happens so fast. My clothes are getting peeled off me. I back into the wall, but there's nowhere to go. I freeze, like a statue. I don't know what's happening. My sweater is being pulled over my head, and his hand pulls my pants down. He bends over and pulls my shoes off. I am now naked. This all happened in the space of about 30 seconds, it feels like. My brain is trying to play catch-up. Alarms are ringing loudly in my head. He takes his clothes off. What the fuck is happening? I'm picked up and placed on the edge of the jacuzzi. I am naked, up to my knees in the hot water. I curl into myself. I did what so many who experience trauma do. I disassociated and left my body. I went up above myself. He gets in the water with a large splash. He pushes me up against the wall. My knees are pressed together. He places his hands on them and pushes my legs apart. I am open wide to a monster. Literally more naked than I have ever been. He places his monster face between my legs. Alarms keep blaring in my head. Wake up, Rose. Wake up, Rose. But I was frozen like a statue if the statue's legs had been spread wide. Anybody who's a sexual assault victim will tell you. The trauma does strange things to your sense of time, your memory. There are details you remember with uncanny accuracy. The shape of the tiles, the yellow quality of the light, the obscene bulbousness of a nose out of all proportion to the rest of a face. And then there are gaps in the timeline where there's nothing. Nothing. Every second extends for a hellish eternity, but it all happens in a flash. And your life is never the same. My life was never going to be the same. Detached from my body, I hover up under the ceiling, watching myself sitting on the edge of a tub, against a wall, held in place by the monster whose face is between my legs, trapped by a beast. In this tiny room, with this huge man, my mind is blank. Wake up, Rose! Get out of here! I try to make sense of what the fuck is going on. How did I get pulled into this position and pushed up against a wall? When did my clothes come off? I don't know what to do. It goes on and on and on. My skin feels like it wants to fall off. His disgusting tongue is inside of me. Oh my God. Tears roll down my face. The water is splashing because he is grabbing himself underwater. One hand holding me, his other holding it. His tongue stabs inside of me again. Wake up, Rose. My brain starts to scramble. Survival instinct kicks in, and I am desperately trying to figure out how to get the fuck away and make it stop. He is slurping and smacking his disgusting lips on me, his fat tongue wet all over my most private parts. Oh my God, stop! I don't know how else to get out of this situation, so I remember the When Harry Met Sally scene with its big fake orgasm. So I did that. I pretended to have an orgasm. I moan loudly, over and over and over, tears falling down my face, mingling with the sweat of the room. He moans loudly. Through my tears, I see his semen floating on top of the bubbles. The fake orgasm works. He seems satisfied, and he sets me down. My legs feel like jelly. He tells me to get dressed. I grab a towel and hurriedly dry myself as best as I can. My whole body is shaking. I try to find my clothes. I'm in total shock and moving somewhat mechanically. I'm still hovering up above, not quite in my body, and I'm trying to put my clothes on and make sense of what has just happened. It's like a race you can't keep up with. My life has been rerouted. I just got hijacked. Later, as I replay what happened over and over, I flash back to those men I saw on my way to that fateful meeting. The grim-faced restaurant host, the assistants who wouldn't look at me. They did this to me just as much as he did, and I hate them for it. I stumble out of the hotel in a state of shock. The MTV camera crew is out there filming, the camera rolling. The first thing I see when I come out is them with their microphone held out in my face, asking me how it went. That footage exists somewhere. I hope I never see it. I immediately get taken to a photo op with my co-star for Phantoms. I am shaking and my eyes fill with tears. I say where I've just come from, and my co-star says, "God damn it, I told him to stop doing that." I don't remember much else from that day other than getting a plane ticket and going home. I wanted to go home and see my friend Ingrid, who had also been sexually assaulted. I knew I could talk to her. She was my best friend. The monster heard I left town and kept trying to call me. He left me messages telling me I was his new special friend. He named other big actresses who worked with him, who won Oscars, and said they were his special friends too. I threw up when I heard his voice. There was no way I was returning his calls. I felt so dirty. I had been so violated, and I was sad to the core of my being. I kept thinking about how he'd been sitting behind me in the theater the night before it happened, which made it not my responsibility exactly, but like I had had a hand in tempting him, which made it even sicker and made me feel dirtier. I know other victims feel this way too. We replay the tape of the event over and over, blaming ourselves. If only, if only, if only. I thought of how I had turned to the MTV cameraman and said, I thought my life was finally getting easier. I wondered if in that moment I'd cursed myself. I'd jinxed it. Even though I know logically none of this is my fault. It was criminal on every level. He was my employer. I was his employee. He was a tremendously influential and powerful player in my industry, and I was a newcomer just barely making a living. He was a huge ogre of a man, and I was a girl. I am crying while I read this. I told him to stop doing that. That comment has haunted me. How fucked up that everyone shook their heads and just looked the other way. But the cover-up was just beginning. During the immediate period afterward, I couldn't stop crying. One of my calls was to my manager. It was so fucked up, she counseled me to see it as something that would help my career in the long run. I threw up. I felt like I was in a funhouse, and all the mirrors were reflecting my horrors. And my manager's instinct was to squash everything, which just freaked me out.